pull up a chair. I want you to imagine flying a four-engine heavy bomber at 50 feet, not 5,000. 50, low enough that you're looking up at the church steeples, low enough that the ripe wheat in the fields is bending flat under your prop wash, and farmers are throwing themselves into the ditches as you thunder over. Now imagine doing that for hundreds of miles, over enemy territory, toward the most heavily defended target on the continent. That happened on August 1943, and 178 bombers went to do it. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar, where we pour a cup of coffee and talk about the airplanes and the people that made this business what it is. Today we're going to talk about a raid that the men who flew it called, plain and simple, the mission. Operation Tidal Wave, the low-level strike on the Ploiești oil refineries in Romania. Stay with me, because this one is going to get under your skin. Before we go any further, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Now, the men we're talking about today never got a coin. They got something heavier. But if you've reached a milestone of your own, go mark it. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. By the summer of 1943, the planners had figured out something that seems obvious now, but took a war to learn. You don't beat a mechanized enemy by knocking out one tank at a time. You beat him by turning off the fuel, and a huge share of the oil that fed the German war machine came out of one place, Ploiești, Romania. Refineries stretched across the landscape, cracking crude into the gasoline that ran the tanks and the trucks and the fighter planes. Somebody did the math and figured Ploiești supplied close to a third of the liquid fuel Germany needed to keep fighting. Turn that off, and the whole thing starts to cough. The trouble was getting there. Ploiești sat a long way from anywhere the Allies could fly from. The bombers would have to launch out of the desert in Libya, cross the Mediterranean, cross the mountains, and press deep into Europe. A round trip of roughly 2,700 miles, that's about as far as flying from New York to Los Angeles and turning around partway to come home in a piston engine bomber. Over water and enemy ground the whole way, the airplane for the job was the Consolidated B-24 Liberator. Now here's where I have to defend an underdog. The B-24 never got the love the B-17 Flying Fortress got. It wasn't as pretty. That slab-sided fuselage, that high Davis wing perched up on top like it was borrowed from somebody else's airplane. Pilots used to joke it was the crate, the fortress came in. But the Liberator flew farther and carried more, and for a mission measured in thousands of miles, range was everything. This was a Liberator job from the start. Here's the part that still makes my hands sweat. The whole plan hinged on going in low. Down on the deck, the idea was to slip in under the German radar, hit the refineries with pinpoint accuracy from treetop height, and be gone before the defenses could wake up. Surprise was the whole ballgame. So, these crews trained for it out in the Libyan desert. They built a mock-up of the target out in the sand, full scale, and they practiced diving these big heavy bombers right down to the deck, and running in on the refineries like fighter pilots. Men who had been taught their whole careers to bomb from 20,000 feet were now learning to bomb from the height of a grain silo. Some of them said later it was the most fun they ever had in an airplane, screaming across the desert at 50 feet in a machine that weighed 30 tons. Of course it was fun in practice, nobody was shooting back. Now here's where it gets interesting, and here's where it starts to go wrong. The morning of August 1st, they launched from the desert near Benghazi, 178 Liberators lifting off into the dust, so much dust that one bomber, heavily loaded, never made it into the air cleanly. And here's the first crack in the plan. The lead navigator's airplane went down in the Mediterranean not long after departure for reasons nobody on the mission ever fully knew, and with it went one of the men who knew the route cold. Radio silence was the rule. You could not talk. Surprise, remember. So there was no easy way to sort out the confusion in the air. They pressed on across the sea, up over the mountains, where the formations climbed into towering clouds and got strung out and separated. By the time they came down the other side and headed for the target, the timing that the whole plan depended on had come apart, and then came the wrong turn. One of the lead groups reached a checkpoint, a town that was supposed to tell them where to swing toward Ploiești, and they turned too early. They turned at the wrong town, and a big chunk of the force followed them because that's what you do, you follow the leader. Suddenly the tail end of that wrong turn is bearing down on Bucharest, the capital, instead of the refineries. Somebody realized the mistake, now they've got to correct. Out loud, breaking the radio silence, they'd guarded all the way from Africa, so much for surprise. By the time they got themselves pointed at Ploesti, the Germans were ready. And I mean ready. Ploesti was ringed with anti-aircraft guns, hundreds of them. Heavy guns, light guns, guns hidden in haystacks that flopped down to reveal their barrels. There was even a flak train, guns mounted on railroad cars that ran alongside the bombers and hammered them from the side. There were barrage balloons with cables strung up to slice a wing off. There were German and Romanian fighters climbing to meet them, and the bombers were coming in at 50 feet. Think about that. At high altitude, flak is a black cloud you fly through and pray. Down low, it's a knife fight. The gunners could look you in the eye. The bombers were so low that the crews were firing their own guns at the flak batteries as they roared over them, and the flak batteries were firing straight into them, muzzle to muzzle. One pilot said the target grew right up in front of the windscreen, and there was nowhere to go but through it. The refineries were on fire before many of them even dropped. The groups that had gotten scrambled by the wrong turn were now arriving out of order, from the wrong directions, some of them flying into smoke and flame from bombs that earlier airplanes had already put down. A few crews flew through walls of fire. Some of those bombs were on delay fuses ticking, so a bomber coming in behind might catch a blast that a bomber ahead of him had planted 30 seconds before. There's a story that lives at the very heart of this raid, and I want to tell it to you the way it was told to me. The lead airplane of one of the groups was flown by a man named Addison Baker, with his co-pilot John Gerstead. As they made their run, their Liberator was hit hard, and it caught fire. Now they were low. Low enough that they could have set that burning airplane down, bellied it into a field, and given the crew a chance to walk away and be captured. That's what the odds said to do. They didn't do it. They stayed on the run. They held that burning bomber on course, leading their group to the target. So the men behind them would have somebody to follow to the aiming point. They led them all the way in, and when they'd done it, the airplane was gone. Both of those men received the Medal of Honor for that. So did three other men on that single mission. 5 Medals of Honor for one day of flying. 3 of them awarded to men who did not come home to receive them. That tells you everything you need to know about what that afternoon over Ploesti was like. Let me pour you a little more coffee, because now we have to talk about getting home. The ones who made it off the target were shot up, streaming fuel, some flying on 3 engines, some on 2, and they still had that whole enormous distance to cross again to get back to Africa. Now they were doing it alone, in 1s and 2s, scattered, wounded, with fighters still coming after them. Some diverted and landed in Turkey, which was neutral, and got interned. Some ditched in the sea. Some crash-landed. Crews nursed airplanes across hundreds of miles of water with holes you could put your arm through and engines that quit one at a time. The airplanes that finally came trailing back into the desert bases that night and the next morning were a wreck of what had left. Of the 178 that started, more than 50 were lost, 50-something Liberators gone. Out of the roughly 1,700 and some men who flew the mission, more than 500 were killed, captured, missing, or wounded. Do that arithmetic. That's close to a third of the men who took off that morning who did not fly home whole that night. It was, by the numbers, one of the costliest single missions the Army Air Forces ever flew. And here's the hard part. The part the old-timers would go quiet about for all that blood. The refineries were not knocked out for good. They were hurt badly, some of them wrecked. But Ploesti had more capacity than it was using, and the Germans patched it up and had much of it running again inside of weeks. They even brought some sections back stronger than before. It took a long campaign of more raids, later, from higher up, to finally choke that oil off for good. So was it worth it? Pilots have argued that one at bar tables for 80 years. Here's how I see it, from this chair. You have to be careful judging what those men did by whether the refineries stayed down. They flew the mission they were handed, and they flew it with a kind of courage that is almost hard to look at directly. A 4-engine heavy bomber at 50 feet is not a weapon. It's an act of faith. Every man in those airplanes knew the odds before he ever started an engine. Some of them wrote letters home the night before that read like goodbyes because they were, and they went anyway. They held burning airplanes on course so the man behind them would have a leader. You do not measure that in barrels of gasoline. There's a lesson in tidal wave for those of us who fly little airplanes on peaceful mornings too, and it's this. The plan is not the mission. Those crews had a beautiful plan. Come in low, catch them asleep, be gone before they wake up, and within an hour of takeoff, the plan was already unraveling. A lost lead ship, clouds over the mountains. A wrong turn at the wrong town, broken radio silence. By the time they reached the target, almost nothing was going the way the briefing said it would, and they flew the mission anyway, with what they had, from where they were. Now, none of us are ever going to face anything like what those men faced, thank God. but every one of us who flies knows that feeling of watching a good plan come apart in the air. The weather isn't what the briefer said. The airplane ahead of you blows a tire on the runway. The airport you were counting on goes below minimums. The measure of a pilot isn't the plan. It's what you do when the plan is gone and you're still up there and you still have to bring it home. Those Ploesti crews wrote the book on that, in the hardest ink there is. If you want to stand next to one of these airplanes, there are a handful of B-24 Liberators left in the world, and only a couple that still fly or flew until recently. Go find one. Walk under that big high wing. Put your hand on the aluminum. And think about a young man, maybe 22 years old, holding that thing steady at 50 feet with the whole sky on fire in front of him, because the men behind him were counting on him not to flinch. My thanks today to the historians at the National Museum of the United States Air Force and the Air Force Historical Research Agency, whose records keep the details of tidal wave from fading, and to the crews themselves, whose own accounts are the only reason we can tell it right. You can find a little more about the show over at radiohanger.com. That's the story of Ploesti, the day 178 heavy bombers went down on the deck, and the men who didn't flinch. Blue skies to all of them. And to you, this is Tail Dragger, signing off.